and did not explicitly authorize crossing the parallel. As Allied troops approached the parallel, China voiced increasing concern. In mid-September, Peking declared that it would stand by the Korean people and criticized the United States for supporting Chiang Kai-shek and blocking China's admission to the United Nations. On September 30th, Foreign Minister Zhou Enlai stated that the Chinese would not, quote, supinely tolerate seeing their neighbors savagely invaded by the imperialists, close quote, and would not stand aside if the parallel were crossed. On October 1st, South Korean troops moved across the parallel, and MacArthur demanded the unconditional surrender of North Korea. Zhou informed the Indian ambassador that if American troops followed across the parallel, China would enter the war. The message was relayed to Washington on October 3, but dismissed by Acheson. Zhou's warning was ignored, the Indian diplomat was written off as an alarmist and communist sympathizer, and United States troops continued across the parallel. MacArthur pushed north and on October 24 swept past the restraining line beyond which only South Korean troops were supposedly to go. 2 days later, a Korean unit along the Yalu, the border between Manchuria and North Korea, encountered Chinese troops and for 4 days engaged in hand-to-hand fighting. Suddenly, the Chinese withdrew. Were they protecting their dams and electric plants across the Yalu? Were they giving the United States a signal that they would intervene in full force if American troops pushed to the Yalu? Acheson expressed his bafflement about their intentions. The stillness was shattered on November 5 when MacArthur received permission to bomb bridges and installations along the Yalu. The war was now on China's border. 4 days later, a strong Chinese attack broke out all along the line, and the Allies were driven back with heavy casualties. MacArthur cabled Washington, "We face an entirely new war."
I'm suggesting that the irony of the Korean War is that later on, MacArthur and others on the right wing would attack the administration for fighting a limited war. But yet, the administration itself, at an earlier juncture, encouraged the hopes for victory, not stalemate or settlement. And indeed, only when it found the costs greatly escalated did it retreat from the effort at unification or victory to a position virtually of stalemate. There's also another dimension to the Korean War which is often overlooked, and that is the huge military budgets of the Korean War are not simply for fighting the Korean War, but also for remilitarizing Europe. Indeed, the real American sponsorship of the militarization of Europe occurs after the beginning of the Korean War. The ultimate irony of all of this, given the earlier administration's encouragement of anti-communism, given the periodic suggestions of victory, given the exaggeration of the communist menace at home and abroad, is when the administration met stalemate, and when stalemate was interpreted as failure, those on the right could attack the administration and exploit the very anti-communist sentiment in America which the administration itself had encouraged.
What do you think is the principal impetus towards this policy?
Well, I think it's based upon an ideological analysis of the world in which...
Is this Truman's analysis?
Yes, I think it's Truman's analysis, and I think this is an analysis which most policymakers, and I would extend it even well into the Johnson years, that most policymakers have shared. And I would characterize as being one that views departures from democracy and capitalism as being ultimately threats to world stability and to American prosperity and democracy which rest upon that world stability. And this interpretation, even totalitarianism, is undesirable to the American ideology, but communism is seen as a more radical evil because it's seen as more tenacious. In that sense, communism threatens, according to the American interpretation, peace and prosperity because it threatens to remove segments of the world from an international capitalistic system and to organize them differently. It's this ideological analysis which I think explains the Cold War and the Truman administration's program. But what's important about this analysis, I think, in part, is the following, that while the general analysis has long prevailed, it still permits differing calculations of the costs of particular events. For example, while we're unhappy and pained, and the administration was domestically troubled by the removal of China from this world system, nevertheless, the cost of trying to keep China would have required, among other things, a commitment of American troops. And that would have been excessive, if not politically impossible. Therefore, the administration reluctantly acceded. The Roosevelt administration, in turn, reluctantly acceded to a sphere of influence arrangement for Eastern Europe, not because it viewed that as the best of all possible worlds, but because it viewed the cost of any effort to change that as being, at that time, excessive. What changed for the Truman administration periodically was a belief that liberation could occur because new weapons were available. And it is, I think, this ideological analysis which explains not simply the origins of the Cold War, but very clearly, under most post-war presidents, the interventions elsewhere in the world.
Truman's presidency from this distance is remarkable for foreign policy decisions, we shouldn't ignore his domestic policies. Truman was supposed to be a one-term president. He ran again in 1948, and his nomination drove the Southern Democrats, the Dixiecrats, out of the party. They nominated their own candidate, Strom Thurmond. On the left, Henry Wallace, FDR's vice president in 1940, took his supporters out of the party and also ran for president, he on the progressive ticket. And this left Harry Truman facing New York's Governor Dewey with only the remnants of the old Roosevelt coalition. He couldn't win, but he did, in one of the political classic upsets. Now, with apologies for the whistle-stop sound effects, which we didn't put there, let's listen to a little Truman versus Dewey.
I'm Harry S. Truman. I work for the government, and I'm trying to keep my job. We're out to win this election, and we're going to do that on the second day of November.
We're going to have a spring house cleaning in January. We're going to have the biggest untangling, unsnarling, weeding, and pruning operation in our history.
He opened his mouth, and he closed his eyes. And he swallowed the terrible record of that good-for-nothing 80th Congress.
Your next administration is going to go forward to make more adequate provisions against the hazards of old age and unemployment.
He said in this campaign that he's for a minimum wage. And I think the smaller the minimum, the better it suits him.
These misnamed Democrats, who pretend to be labor's friends, ask for power to put labor in chains, and that's the reason they ought to be thrown out of office.
When the Republican candidate finished telling you here in Pittsburgh how labor had suffered under my administration, he told you who had come to the rescue of labor. Well, how do you suppose they did it? They did it with the Taft-Hartley law. That's how they came to the rescue of labor.
As never before, we need a rudder to our ship of state, and we need a firm hand at the tiller. And they have now, I am sorry to say, reached a new low of mudslinging. That is the kind of campaign I have refused to wage, and I never will.
But well, if it's mudslinging, to go out to the people of the United States, at every corner of the United States, and nearly every state in the Union, and tell them what the facts of life are, then I'm a mudslinger.
Part of Truman's astounding victory is attributable to the fact that he was the most human president since Warren Harding. Just how human, in light of recent White House occupants' public postures, is difficult to imagine. Merriman Smith, the White House correspondent for United Press International, wrote a book about his work in 1946. And while the book isn't particularly distinguished in any other respect, it has a lot of interesting anecdotal information about Harry Truman. This is Merriman Smith writing. One of Washington's veteran correspondents, assigned by his newspaper to write a color story about the new president, said, "This man's color lies in his utter lack of color. He's Mr. Average. You see him on your bus or your streetcar. He sits next to you at the drugstore soda fountain. There must be millions like him." No president before Mr. Truman has enjoyed so much dressing up in dinner clothes. He's an impressive figure at evening in either dinner jacket or tails, and he's meticulous about his clothes. The four sharp points of his breast pocket handkerchiefs and his business suits attest to this. He's proud of his trim physique and his physical hardiness. He has the rugged constitution of a man many years his junior. Before becoming president, he kept in physical trim by long walks. Now his walking is limited largely by the iron fence surrounding the White House grounds, and so most of his exercise is in the White House swimming pool or pulling wall weights installed for him by the side of the pool. Some writers have blown up to inane and inaccurate proportions Mr. Truman's alleged love for bourbon whiskey. As a matter of fact, he prefers scotch. He once favored bourbon, but someone gave him a case of scotch several years ago and he learned to like it. Actually, most stories dealing with Mr. Truman's drinking habits are overdrawn. They tend to show him as a man who likes his whiskey, and for that matter, Franklin Roosevelt liked his whiskey too, and not much was ever made of it. Poker is a relaxing hobby with Harry Truman, and he has another hobby too, reading history. But because reading history is a rather colorless pastime, the public usually skips over this fact and reads with interest how the president dealt a few hands the other night with some of his friends. The stakes seem to matter little when the president plays poker. He'd as soon play for nickels as for dollars. He's a smart player, largely through his ability to size up his opponents in a hurry. When he's playing with old friends, he inclines toward recklessness and wild games, many of them known by their particular names only in Missouri. Mr. Truman has some trouble accepting his role as president. For one thing, he likes long walks before breakfast. The 40-odd acres of the White House grounds inhibit him, so for a brief time, the president, accompanied by two Secret Service men, walked along the streets near the White House. He took these walks early in the morning, starting out at 7 o'clock or earlier, but he was soon discovered, and there were stories in every newspaper of the nation. The president was disappointed. He thought that the next time he went for a walk near the White House, he would be followed by photographers, reporters, and assorted spectators. Stubbornly refusing to walk under such circumstances, the president figured out a new system. He got in his long black limousine in the morning and drove to the outskirts of Washington, where he got out and did his walking in rural seclusion. Because he used different locations, it became virtually impossible for the reporters and photographers to outguess or anticipate him, and that made him feel good again. And one final story. In the first few months, Mr. Truman was quite naive about the presidency. This was first visibly demonstrated about a month after he took office. He had some business to do with his banker, so, with little warning to anyone, he called for his automobile and set out for the Hamilton National Bank at 14th and G Streets in Washington. He decided to do this at the lunch hour. The Secret Service had hurriedly ordered escort cars and notified the District of Columbia Police. When the entourage stopped in front of the bank, traffic was tied up during the busy lunch hour for blocks in every direction. When the president came out of the bank and found a cheering crowd waiting for him, he was highly embarrassed. He waved his Western-style hat at the people in sort of an apologetic way, and then literally leaped into the car, and off he went. Those are little excerpts from Merriman Smith's book entitled Thank You, Mr. President. Well, in any case, probably because of these kinds of things, Truman won in 1948. And we might as well pause here for an audio classic, Harry Truman recalling how he learned about that victory on election night, 1948.
I had my sandwich and glass of buttermilk and went to bed at 6:30. And along about 12 o'clock, I happened to wake up for some reason. And the radio was turned on. And Mr. Kaltenbarn was saying, while the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote, we have yet to hear. And we are very
sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by another family. And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
So now Truman had been elected president in his own right. The question is, what did he do with his mandate, if such it was?
He claimed publicly to view it as a mandate, and I think he did. Ironically, he only had about a year and a half, that is, he only had about a year and a half with that mandate before the Korean War. And as a result, secured almost none of the significant legislation. What is striking is, in the case of civil rights, that he periodically made bold legislative requests. There is, I think, some reason to doubt whether he was as fully committed to the programs as his public rhetoric would have suggested. And I suggest that there's reason for doubt for two reasons. One is he seldom used vigorous tactics to support the programs in Congress, and that at least is indirect evidence on commitment. Secondly, quite often he had considerable authority in areas of executive decision-making where he could have significantly advanced civil rights, was often reluctant, hesitant, or fragmentary in his action. For example, he was asked during the Korean War to set up a federal commission to halt discrimination on government contracts and in government employment. Well, he did ultimately create a rather limited committee with a very small budget and which exercised practically no commitment to the enterprise. And Truman seems never to have been particularly interested in this. It was a committee on government complaints. The result is that the committee, during its years, did almost nothing. It had a handful of hearings and probably improved conditions in a handful of factories, but nothing significant. It was quite often the case in civil rights that Truman made bold legislative demands, and in areas where he had substantial authority, didn't act or acted in fragmentary and certainly less than fully committed form. I think that he was prepared to countenance these programs and would probably even have liked them if they could have been established without any political cost and without any investment of his own capital.
Truman's presidency was the period of the post-war Red Scare, of the blacklists, of McCarthyism's beginnings, of the Alger Hiss spy case, of the conviction of the Rosenbergs for passing wartime secrets to the Soviets. The Truman years were highly charged and not especially positive in terms of civil liberties. I asked Barton Bernstein about this aspect of Harry Truman's career.
After the election of 1946 and the triumph of the Republican Party, the administration began its own loyalty program at home. And in that program, and in its standards, in its loose attention to protection for the accused, and in its dramatic exaggeration of the communist threat at home, did contribute, it seems to me, to anti-communism. Now, it's not clear that the original program was conceived primarily to help Truman achieve goals in foreign policy. It happens, however, of course, that the anti-communism which he encouraged at home assisted him in selling foreign policy programs which were cast within an anti-communist framework. So there was at least a reciprocal influence, although it's not clear in the beginning the influence was intentional. Some have gone so far as to suggest that there was an intentional design to create anti-communism in order to secure these foreign policies at that time.
Is there any evidence that he tried to damp it down?
Well, one can contend that his creation of the loyalty program was an attempt at least to stop the Republicans or disarm them from attacking him and the New Deal, Fair Deal tradition. He did make occasional comments about the care that was necessary in accusing and using labels. It's also true, however, that he was often cavalier. The administration went beyond attacking communism to attacking those who allied with communists, those who looked like communists, and those who, in fact, opposed the administration's foreign policy. The administration contributed significantly, it seems to me, to the notion that dissent was disloyal and that its foreign policy was patriotic and that the foreign policies of opponents might well be unpatriotic. Certainly there was a tendency to view the opponents of the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and NATO, especially when they were not clearly right-wing people, as being communists or almost communists. And that way, the administration contributed significantly, it seems to me, to the repression of dissent, to the inhibitions in dialogue, to the restricted focus of discussion. And in many ways, the administration was aware of this and occasionally even sought to do so. For example, in 1947, Clark Clifford, then the president's close advisor, and later to be known to many of us as Secretary of Defense in the Johnson administration, urged Truman, in seeking re-election in 1948, to have the liberals attack the Progressive Party and the opponents of his foreign policy, and to use anti-communist techniques. Certainly it's clear that Truman himself red-baited Henry Wallace in 1948. Probably the greatest visible culprit in the administration was Attorney General Tom Clark, the father of Ramsey Clark. Clark not only created the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations, but acted often to thwart and persecute dissent.
We've spent most of the past hour trying to assess Truman's years. Out of all of this information comes a final, larger question. Was Truman the creator or the creature of his times?
Well, I think that in theory, given the powers of the presidency, he had the opportunity, particularly in foreign policy, to chart a different course of events, and thereby to avoid at least the bitter Cold War that ensued, as well as the hot war in Korea, and the what I regard as a waste of American funds, as well as a waste of American lives and the lives of others. However, it may, in all fairness, be the most meaningful question to ask, would another have acted differently? On Roosevelt, had he lived, it's hard to say. I suspect he might have followed patterns quite similar to those that Harry Truman followed, perhaps with more deftness, certainly with more charisma. One might even ask the larger question, and that is whether the American political system is so structured that men of uncommon background, with uncommon ideas, are likely to rise to the top and to redirect that system. I'm not at all convinced that the American political system, given its concentration of power, given its ideology, and given the kind of recruitment of individuals as they pass through the process, that it is prepared to, able to, or has, in the last 30 years, produced on the national scene any leader of magnitude who would have been likely ever to command the support of either party and thereby to win a nomination and ultimately the presidency. In tactics, in personality, in style, in the minor things which we concentrate upon so often, both in life and in our analysis, he gave the period a flavor all his own. But I'm not sure that the magnitude of the period would have been greatly different had another man been at the helm of state.
You've been listening to a special report about Harry Truman's term as President of the United States. You might call it the revised standard version of Harry Truman. I've drawn upon Truman's memoirs, the writings of Ronald Steele, Merriman Smith, Charles Bolin, and audio material from Edward R. Murrow's I Can Hear It Now, plus a conversation with Barton Bernstein, Associate Professor of History at Stanford University. This program was created for Pacifica Radio, and I was the producer. My name is Bill Schechner. That program came to you on recording. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. In stereo, The Dragon Lady's Revenge.